Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 7th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome back William Friedkin. What number was that for you?
I've seen this over 200 times, way more. And it never fails to move me. I think what he had in mind was, what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world if he loses his own soul? I think that's what he had in mind. But how the hell do I know? I just think it's absolutely great. The music plays such a great part in telling the story. And it was written in a very short period of time by Bernard Herrmann, who I'm sure many of you know, wrote a lot of scores for Hitchcock, including Psycho. And he wrote, I think the last, or one of the last he did was Taxi Driver. That was the very last one?
He died during production, I think.
I went to see Bernard Herrmann after Hitchcock had rejected two of Herrmann's scores. Bernard Herrmann moved out of the United States, and he moved to London, where he wasn't doing a lot of work or taking a lot of assignments. But I came to him, and I ran for him the rough cut of The Exorcist, because I wanted him to do the score for The Exorcist. And I went to London, brought the print to him, and first we talked a lot about Citizen Kane. He dismissed that, and then he dismissed Hitchcock. And then I ran The Exorcist for him. And he came out of the screening room, which was at the William Morris Agency in London. It was formerly the home of George Friedrich Handel, called Handel House. And I ran The Exorcist for him, and he came out of the screening, and he said, he was a salty old guy from, I think, the Bronx. And he came out of the screening room, and he said, well, I think I might be able to help this piece of shit for you. He said, just leave it with me, and I'll see what I can do. He said, but you got to take that crazy first scene out of there. You know, that desert scene with these guys with the turbans and stuff. He said, get rid of that. What is it? What does it mean? You probably won't get rid of it because it costs you a bundle to make it. He said, but it means nothing, and it kills your picture. And I said, so you really don't want any input from me about what I think about for the score at all, do you? He said, kid, how many pictures have you made? I think I'd made 4, 5 maybe. He said, you know how many films I've scored, radio shows? He said, I scored Citizen Kane, kid. Are you going to tell me about what you want for your score for this piece of junk? And I said, could you just tell me what you have in mind? He said, yes. He said, there's a church in a, it's called St. Giles Cripplegate. It's in an area of London known as Cripplegate. It's got the most beautiful organ sound I've ever heard. And I'll do the whole score in that church with that organ. And I said, you want to use a church organ in The Exorcist? He said, yeah. I stood up and I put out my hand and I said, thank you for letting me meet an interesting person. I tell that story. It's somewhat humorous. It was probably the saddest moment I've had because I really respected him and loved his work, and I think there's no one better. And the score really seals this picture for me. Would anyone like to start off and let's talk about this? Not as a Q&A, you know, because I don't know what the hell. You know, I know everything I've read about Kane. A lot of it's conflicting. But, you know, I'd love to hear from you guys. Yes, sir. I don't know if you heard that. The gentleman said that Hitchcock started his career working in German studios, though he was a British director, but a lot of his early films and The Silence were made in Germany, and he was influenced by German expressionism, was Wells, because there are certainly many touches of expressionism in the cinematography. When Wells went to Hollywood, he had a wish list of films he wanted to see. Films by John Ford, his favorite being Stagecoach, which he claimed to have seen 40 times. He did admire the German Expressionists, especially Fritz Lang. And he saw films by many people, Capra and Hawks and many others. And there was a woman at RKO who prepared for him strips of film which were annotated that indicated what a long shot was, what a medium shot was, what a close-up looked like. And he had these strips of film in a notebook, and he would very often change them out. When he got to Hollywood, though he had shot a couple of things, not a feature film, he had shot some film for plays he had done, but he really had never made a feature film, and he didn't even know the language, which is why Toland wanted to work for him. Wells spent a day in every workshop at RKO, learning about the capacity of the lighting, what the mounts could do, what the lenses could do. And he went out there and for at least a year gave himself a tutorial in many things. He was certainly not the first filmmaker to use ceilings in a film or to use the kind of flashbacks that he used. That was from a Preston Sturges film that had the story told from many points of view. There were very few things that were done for the first time by Wells. What Mae West said is true of Wells. It ain't what I do, it's the way that I do it. And that's what makes this film so unique and original. He took existing techniques and put them together in what was a unique and refreshing manner. And he used a lot of radio-type transitions because he came out of dramatic radio with the Mercury Theater. So, and he listened to the sound library at RKO, which was extensive, and added a lot of sounds. But it's some of the transitions are amazing. And I think they were probably done for the first time that I can tell, and they come from his experience in radio. But expressionism was certainly a big part of what he was doing. Certainly, this film looks a lot different from Caligari, which is probably the height of German expressionistic filmmaking. Yes. Yes, ma'am. I never read that. I don't know whether he saw that or not. Yeah. The snow scene, yes. The young woman asked if he might have watched Abel Gance's Napoleon. I doubt that that was out then. It had been missing for years.
Actually, I just heard an interview with Wells right after Gance died, and he was asked his opinion of Gance. He had worked with Gance, actually. Remember, Gance made a Napoleon in the 50s that Wells was in, and Wells said, "I do not rate him highly among filmmakers. I have to be honest." He was honest. He said he had won a Magnificent Obsession, and he knew him.
The filmmaker he rated most highly was John Ford, and particularly Stagecoach. He is quoted as saying that John Ford, though he didn't know him well, was his mentor. But that's, I think, very astute, that might he have looked at that. The glass ball, the snow scene, the prop master went all over Hollywood looking for the particular glass ball that Wells wanted and couldn't find it. So they brought a glass blower in and made that. He wanted, it's hard to see, but it's a snow scene, of course, with a house and a little boy standing in front of it holding a sled. And they couldn't find such a glass ball, so they made it. Yeah, way in the back, sir.
You know the business of Hollywood better than any of us. What do you think was the reason that Orson never really went to his full capacity as a director after Citizen Kane?
Well, many film historians think that he made better films. I think he made a number of interesting films, but not this good. Where do you go if you start there? You know, if you start with a film that is so unique and original, what the hell are you going to do? Well, his second film might have been equally as great if the studio didn't take it away from him. And I don't know, they say there's 40 minutes that was taken out of it after a preview in Pasadena where the audience laughed at the Magnificent Ambersons. And so Robert Wise was called in to take 40 minutes out, and they got some staff director at RKO to reshoot the last 40 minutes, and it's pretty awful. But the rest of the film is great and different. Wells doesn't appear in it. But the missing 40 minutes of the Magnificent Ambersons is the holy grail of Hollywood. People have been looking for that, you know, since 1943. And the Paramount Studios own what was at the time RKO. It later became Desilu. But it was RKO, and it was where they shot Kane and Ambersons, number of other films. It was a part of Paramount. And I remember talking to the guy who was the head of post-production at Paramount, who happens to be the smartest man I ever met in the film world. And his name was Paul Hager. He was the head of post-production. You remember him?
Yeah.
He was the guy in charge of making sure they got the good prints out to the theaters on time. And he was brilliant. You couldn't bullshit Paul. And one day I went to his office and I said, "Hey, Paul, maybe in the basement at the RKO part of Paramount, there might be the missing footage from Ambersons. Why don't you send an assistant editor over there to take a look in the basement, where they had a lot of cans of film, many of which they destroyed." He sent over an assistant. This is about 20 years ago. He sent an assistant over to scan whatever the hell they had on shelves and didn't know. And the assistant found a pile of cans of 35 millimeter film that was simply labeled Wells film. It just said Wells film in tape, written with a magic marker. Most of the stuff that they had, all the studios, they just threw away. But here were all these cans of Wells film. And they were brought to Paul's office. And it turned out there was no soundtrack at all. Just a whole bunch of unedited reels of the film that became It's All True, which is the film that he shot in Rio, and there was a sequence shot in Mexico. It was a three-part film that he never finished. He went down to South America to the carnival in Rio to shoot it while the studio was screwing up Amberson's. And he was sent copies of the recuts of Amberson's, all of which he loathed and was disgusted by. And I think that was, he did another film shortly after that, You're Gonna Run, The Stranger, this weekend. He did Journey into Fear. But I think he had lost it. When Amberson's was destroyed, you can imagine, he is quoted as, when he came to Hollywood, age of 25, he was quoted as having said, "This is the biggest and best electric train set a boy ever had." And then they just took the train away from him and broke it. That might be an answer to your question. I don't think he ever... There's some other films that I really like. Of course, Touch of Evil, I think, is a great movie. There's a lot of great movies in the street right now. And over the years, there have been a handful of films I think we would all agree are really good or great films. There's only one Citizen Kane. For me, that's it. It doesn't get any better than that. And I don't know where he would have gone. He was certainly self-destructive. Perhaps the most self-destructive genius that Hollywood ever produced. There were others destroyed, but not by themselves. Wells basically gave it all away. Yes, sir.
It's amazing that not only was he the director of this film, but he was the star of it. And my question to you is it harder or easier to direct the film that you're starring in?
Only a handful of people have done it with any success at all. Chaplin, of course. You'd have to say, you know, Mel Gibson. But the names come hard of guys who gave a performance like that, where he ages 50 years and is convincing at all ages, and with the kind of acting that's in that. But he knew what was best for him. I imagine there were few people who ever really successfully directed him as well as he did himself, and only in that film. Although he did direct The Stranger, which he appears in, with Edward G. Robinson and Loretta Young. That's definitely worth seeing. It was made in 1946. But Wells began to slide down right after Amberson's. But fortunately, the movie god left us with his masterpiece, you know? But I don't know anybody around today who could direct themselves. I can only refer to it in terms of the people who are making really good and interesting films as a director or as an actor, but I don't know any that could do what he did in this picture. And supervise everything else as well. Yes, sir.
So now that we've seen the film, can you reveal the sequence that Greg Tolan shot from the hole in the floor?
Yeah, it's the scene. It's almost the entire scene after he loses the election, when he and Jed Leland are alone in the empty campaign headquarters, and Leland tells him he wants to leave and go to Chicago. And Wells agrees to let him go. The whole scene was shot from a hole in the floor. You know, I've asked for a lot of crazy things in my day, but never to cut a hole in the floor.
Can I follow
and up? And now you see the scene, and it's so dramatic. It's so great.
Can you explain what you think he was trying to achieve by that extreme
placement? The low angle? It's for dramatic purposes. You know, it's hard to... You have to go to Dan Brown to find out what Da Vinci had in mind when he painted The Last Supper, right? I don't know what the... You know, he had a... Look, he had the biggest electric train set a boy ever had. And now, fortunately, you know, and at that time, there were few, if any, women that were directing then or had the opportunity to direct. Now I think you're going to see some marvelous films from a lot of the women that are directing today and finding new ways to tell a story. There's a woman named Jennifer Kent. I don't know if any of you have seen The Babadook. Have you? How many? It's pretty damn good. It's one of the best horror films I've ever seen. It was directed by a woman in Australia. The film was a disaster. It was made in Perth. Then went to London. Disaster. Then it came over here in a handful of theaters, and I started tweeting about it. And now they're getting hundreds of bookings. In fact, I've been asked to introduce it at the IFC before I... Should I pass? I have introduced that film, and it is right now the best horror film I've seen in years. And it's very original. It's a psychological horror film made by a woman whose first feature film this was. So let's hope that Jennifer Kent doesn't have the same self-destructive impulses that Mr. Welles had. I never met Orson Welles, but I met a lot of people who knew him very well. I met and became very friendly with Stanley Cortez, who was the cinematographer of Amberson's, who Welles did not get along with or like. He loved Toland. It was a real love affair, and it's on the screen.
Stanley didn't get along with anybody.
Stanley?
Yeah.
Stanley was an artist, and he let you know it. You know, he let everybody know it. Roman Polanski fired him off Rosemary's Baby after a week. But he had photographed some great films like The Snake Pit and Since You Went Away. He was Stanley Krantz. His brother was Ricardo Cortez.
Latin star was really Jewish.
Yeah, they're Jewish, but we don't hold that against them. Do we? It's hard to tell anymore. But anyone else want to say? Yes. Come on up here. Here, come here. Go ahead.
Because you were talking about the deep focus cinematography in the beginning, and I mean, even in The Babadook, and I mean, even in your kind of recent films, I've noticed kind of a more of a going to more of the close-ups and more of not the deep focus. And I think a lot of that's because the screens are getting smaller, because we're watching a lot on TV, because the medium right now is very innovative as far as TV goes. Do you think deep focus cinematography is going to become a completely lost art?
Lost is probably too strong a word. What's your name?
Ben.
Ben. But, of course, the close-up has influenced the theatrical film. When Welles made Citizen Kane, you couldn't go to another medium and see a bunch of close-ups, you know. Although they were being shot for the films who were being made, Welles' idea of making Citizen Kane was to deeply immerse the audience in the story, make it look real. He was trying to, for the most part, put you in the scene, and that meant limited cutting. Not a lot of cuts, not a lot of choices to be made afterwards in the editing room, but shoot the scenes so that they could play out almost in full and allow the audience to decide where they wanted to look, as on the stage. If you see a play, You can decide where you want to look, a play or an opera, at any time. Now, the director of a play or an opera can, by means of staging, emphasis, and lighting, can direct your attention somewhat. But basically, in the theater from which Wells came, it's the audience's choice, and he tried to bring that to the movies with Kane. Let the audience decide where and who they want to look at. But yes, now all of cinema has been influenced by television in terms of the way they're presented. Thank you, Ben.
For one more?
This gentleman?
After having seen the...
Can you pass this?
We have one.
Let's go.
No, we have one.
Oh, you got one?
Yeah.
Yeah, go to work.
Thank you. After having seen the film so many times, do you identify a point in the film where he lost his soul, or is it gradual?
I think it's gradual. I think it starts in the very first scene where he leaves his mother. The sled, to me, obviously represents the last time he was really loved by someone just for himself. A very wonderful and marvelous concept. I don't know how many of you are aware of the false rumor that made the rounds over many decades about what the real meaning of Rosebud was in terms of William Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies. It's supposedly, I have no way of knowing whether this is true or not, or how anyone but them would have known this, but Mankiewicz put out the story that that's what Hearst called Marion Davies' sexual organ, Rosebud. And I even read a book where they sent us to the definition of the female organ as often being referred to as a rose. Rosebud is the sled, I'm pretty sure. But this is Hearst. For a long time, they said, Wells said, it's not Hearst. To call this Hearst is an insult to both Hearst and Citizen Kane. But it was Hearst. And then Hearst finally saw it. And he saw it in the presence of Wells's first wife, Virginia Nicholson, who Orson divorced after 4 years of marriage. And she later married a very prominent writer and producer named Charles Lederer, who was a beloved nephew of Marion Davies. And Lederer took Virginia Nicholson up to San Simeon a number of times. And on one occasion, Lederer describes that they were all called into the screening room, and without any announcement, they ran Citizen Kane. And Hearst was sitting through the whole picture, and when it was over, because he tried to ban it and destroy Wells, destroy RKO, and we have Virginia Nicholson's testimony that when the picture finished, Hearst and Marion Davies just stood up. He had a faint smile on his face and didn't say a word and left. There is nothing on record to know how Hearst felt about it, but he did try to kill it. But mostly it was the people around Hearst. Luella Parsons, who was his movie columnist, and Hedda Hopper, who was not, but both of whom reported to him that the film was scandalous and dreadful, and they panned it. And the people who promoted it the most and tried to save it were Hearst's rival, the Henry Luce Empire. Henry Luce tried to buy the film.
He was satirized too, The March of Time.
Yes, but In a good way.
In a good way.
But Luce wanted to buy the film when Louis Mayer offered the full. The film cost $805,000, and it's shown on the books of RKO as having lost $150,000. So it never made money as a first run or second run release. God knows what it's made on video now and repertory showings and television. But if Wells was a profit part, he was a 25% profit participant, he still wouldn't get a dime because of studio accounting. There was a man who we have to mention who was Wells' greatest supporter, stood by him all this time. He was the head of RKO who signed Wells, George Schaefer. He went to the bat against the wishes of the board of directors. They wanted to ban it. It was a worst-case scenario than Sony and The Interview, because they knew, well, the Hearst papers never took an ad for Citizen Kane and a lot of other RKO movies. And they forced a lot of theaters not to take it. The film was supposed to open at Radio City Music Hall. The Hearst people went to them and said, forget it, and they did.
Well, I think it's going to make its negative cost back tonight, thanks to you.
Thank you all for
coming. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
it was a pleasure, I have to say. It was a pleasure to share this with you and to hear from the last row, not a sound.
And no texting.
And no what?
Right? Texting.
No text. I didn't notice any texting. But what I noticed more than that, not a sound. And you're such a wonderful and attentive audience. If I can sense anything about the great master that was Orson Welles, he would have appreciated this screening a whole hell of a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And by the way, you will be back Friday night for the Magnificent Ambersons.
Sure.
And Friday night, 7:50, Magnificent Ambersons, you will be back. And on Sunday at 1 o'clock for The Stranger.
Look forward to it.
It's advertised, so you better. Okay, thank you.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.